Just remember the section coming back, but not the full section. And that was just a moment that has always been ingrained and very weird, and just no one speaking, and just the emotions of that kind of that moment. Like, we'd gone from pretty much planning a New Year's Eve little barbecue as much as you can out there, to then everything just changing. And I think that was the moment for everyone that it kind of really hit that it's different now. I'm Daniel Vernon, a former Royal Marine Commando, served 10 years. And after I left, I moved to America. So join me on the episode to hear about the transition and life in the UK compared to American veterans and where we can do better for ourselves. Thank you.
Welcome to another edition of The Kick Cage, and please give a very warm welcome to Dan Vernon. Dan, how are you, sir?
I'm good, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. A Royal Marine Commando living in the United States now. Now, This is going to be one hell of a topic of conversation, how we got from point A to point B. So, as always, I would like to kick it off with, you know, you growing up, what sort of person you were, and what turned your direction of life towards the military?
Yeah, so I think from a young age, I always really wanted to join the military, kind of, you know, as a little boy playing with your action men. And as I got a little older, my cousin joined the parachute regiment, and he deployed to Iraq. And then I kind of just started looking into it more. I was speaking to people about what kind of units to join. And I think at that point, looking back, I was a big introvert. And I kind of assessed that I wanted to get away from that, and how could I make changes to kind of improve that. And I kind of looked at pushing myself into that life would be a big change for me. So kind of spoke to my dad, and he told me about the commandos at that point. And I looked into them, and they had the longest training, and everything said it was extremely hard. So I kind of leant towards them from probably 14. So that's when I started that kind of journey.
That seems to be a very young age for you to realize within yourself that you're a bit of an introvert and you wanted to push yourself. Was there male characters around you at that time that you wanted to emulate? The reason why you wanted to push yourself?
Not really. So my parents broke up when I was extremely young. So I lived with my mom, kind of saw my dad every 2 weeks. I think my granddad was a veteran. He was in the army, and he kind of showed me old pictures from when I was young, kind of, you know, black and white kind of pictures of him. And then with my cousin joining as well, that kind of made me look at it again. And then from there, it's just something I always kind of had in my mind of, you know, what do you do next after high school, after your A levels, like, where are you going to go? And that just seemed like a path that kind of would put the positives about myself in a good light, that I could kind of push strength from my weaknesses, but also use the strengths I did have in a positive way.
At what age were you when you signed on the dotted line?
So I did high school, and then I did my A levels, and I joined the reserves for 2 years while I did that. And then probably that last year before you finish, I signed up for the Marines, and then kind of went through that process over that year of doing the tests and going in and doing the little 2-day things and passing all of those. And then as soon as I finished my A-levels, it was probably a month or something after that, I jumped on the train and started my training.
You mentioned there that you were in the reserves for a period of time before you joined the full-time military. What branch was that?
I believe it was Army. I think it was either Signals or Remy. They kind of had a joint attachment. I can't actually remember which one I ended up going through. But I did that and went away from some exercises and kind of that training. And that showed me a little bit into that world.
Was your thought process on that it would give you a taste before you signed up fully? And was that taste something that you wanted more of?
Yeah, I think it might have been my granddad I'd spoke to, and he kind of taught me about the reserves, and he used to come and drive like 40 minutes to come get me. He'd take me to their base where it was near me, and he'd just sit outside for 2 hours, wait for me to finish, and then drive me home. And that kind of gave me that first taste of that life. But I remember as I was getting towards the end and they kind of knew I'd signed up, it was quite interesting that like the sergeant major there, I remember him talking to me and kind of saying, oh, that's really hard and you won't be able to do it and you should kind of just go this way. And I think that just kind of spurred me on even more.
Give you that sort of drive to prove him wrong. Yeah. So your first experience of getting off that training and heading towards your real basic training away from the reserves and, going into the Royal Marines, how did you feel as you first arrived there and you were seeing your drill instructors for the first time? Was it nervous, apprehension, or was this, the life that you were looking for?
I think it's a mix of all of those things, to be honest. I can't remember it too well anymore, but I kind of remember getting off and you just see, there's like 60 other lads lined out on the train station. So for what we do, we jump on a train and it has its own little train station outside Limpston training, and you jump off and your drill leader's instructor's right there and already screaming at you, getting you lined out. And it's kind of that shock of that first moment of, oh yeah, this is different than the life I've had and been leading.
That initial shock and awe of capture of, breaking you down and then molding you back into what the British military wants. Mm-hmm. As you were going through that first initial training, were there some of the instructors that you looked up to and wanted to emulate as you were going through your military career?
Yeah, I don't think it was at that point that I really started looking at that, because at that point you're so just shocked and like you don't really realize like the things these people have done already and the level they are at. Obviously you see them with the Green Beret and you look at that the whole time and that you want that, but they're not the nicest people when you know them in training.
Well, that's because they have a job to do, isn't it? They need to sift through the people that put their name forward to find the people that are strong enough in body and mind to be able to wear that Green Beret. How long was that basic training process? And if you could give us a little bit of an insight into what the almost selection is for going for the Green Beret.
Yeah, so once you actually pass all the initial tests, so, like education tests, like maths, English, those basic ones, and you do your basic running and press-ups and pull-ups to get to that point of getting on that train and starting the actual training. And then the basic training is 8 months in total. And they kind of break it up. The first half is kind of the Marine training and the second half is kind of that commando training. And it's interesting, like you see people when you first get there, and I think I was 18 when I started, and you see guys, I was pretty small for my age, and you see these big muscly guys, and it's funny, as you kind of go through training you kind of see those drop off, they don't make it. And I think that kind of, in a sick way, I kind of enjoyed that. I like seeing them at the start, like these big guys that a little bit cocky, and kind of seeing them give up as you go, and then you're like, you're still going. So I quite enjoyed that aspect of it.
Was it quite a high attrition rate for the candidates going on that course?
Yeah, I think we started with, I'd say about 70 people, And I think by the end, we had around 10 originals by the time we got to the end of training.
Wow.
So quite a lot dropped off.
And how do you feel you grew as a person during this training period from, you know, the young lad that went in that was very introvert? How do you feel that this process changed you, and what was the person that emerged from it?
Yeah, I'd say I was probably on the more immature side for my age, but I think that actually helped me a little bit. I was kind of just, I would do whatever I was told, whereas you had some of the older lads and, you know, you start questioning, why are you making us do this? Why have we got to go do that? Why are you punishing us when we didn't really do anything? Whereas you're kind of young and dumb, you do whatever you get told to do. So that kind of just helped me. I was just gray man, like never really stood out, but never dropped behind. I just kind of stayed in that middle, and you kind of have your corporal meetings every now and then as you go through training, and he would always be telling me, like, you need to stop being a gray man. And I was like, I'm perfectly happy. I'm just floating along. And I kind of excelled on the physical side. So endurance things, I'd normally come in the top kind of three for any of those. And then probably the upper body, I was kind of lower down for like pull-ups and things like that. But I never found a point through training where I felt like I wanted to quit. Like it never, even though it was extremely hard and would break you, I kind of just had that mindset that I kind of enjoyed it, and kind of almost that challenge of, can they break me? And then not wanting to be broken. So I kind of enjoyed that and managed to kind of switch my mind to seeing that as fun.
That's good. So at the end of this process, is this when you get your lid, your beret, and talk us through that moment? How proud were you for that moment?
So at the end of training, you do your commando test. So I'm going to get slated because I'm going to forget the order of them. But there's four of them, and I think it's the speed march first. So it's 9 mile speed march, kind of your battle gear on and your rifle, and you do that together. And I think that's one of the ones that gets a lot of people out, because it sounds a little easier than some of the others, but it's actually probably one of the ones that I struggled with the most, because I have a really short stride and you have to stay in step with everyone and as a group. So that gets quite difficult in kind of just keeping with them and not tripping over anyone. Then you have the endurance course, which is, I think it's like 4 miles of tunnels and underwater and going through different obstacles, and then like a 4 mile run back. And I used to really enjoy that one, because you'd start off in a group of three and you'd go to the first kind of big obstacle and you do that together. And it's a sheep dip where they kind of push you fully underwater and you have to go through a tunnel.
Yeah.
So you have one guy on one end that kind of pushes you down, pushes you through. And then the guy on the other end that kind of be reaching his hand out to try and find you and pull you through. But once you get through that, you go off on your own. And it's just basically every man for himself, best effort. So I quite enjoyed that one. And then you have the Tarzan assault course. So it's more of kind of air assault course. You kind of ropes and jump in from one station through a rope ladder and high obstacle kind of things. And then you go, I think you get like 12 minutes or something to do that one. And then the last one obviously is the 30 miler. And you go off to, I believe it's Dartmoor, we do it in. And you start off early and you go off and they kind of break you up into your groups. And that one's just long and tough, but kind of for me anyway, like once I got to that kind of 15 miles, you know, everything's counting down then, like you're getting towards that finish. And that's where once you finish that, you cross the bridge and there's people lined out kind of clapping you, like local veterans that live in the area come out, and that's where you get presented your Green Beret. And that is a very awesome moment to finally be done.
So once you've done all this, you've got your beret. Is it Do you go on to specialised training, some sort of trade training?
So we do, once you finish basic, you get 2 years as a what we call a GD Marine. So you're basically just in a rifle group, in a rifle unit. And then within that, you can specialise, but you kind of get 2 years of kind of a safety net. So it's kind of what I consider one of the good things about what we do, but it's also the worst side, is we kind of specialise in everything. So the thing that they stand out for, kind of the government level of why should we have commandos, is we can be deployed anywhere, and we have that SQ for every position. So we can just go, we don't need the army or the RAF or anyone to kind of help us once we get there. We can just set up and we have people within the unit that cover all those jobs. But with that, then you kind of get a lot of your jobs that you don't want to do and you didn't really join to do, like, you know, the signaler and clerks and chefs and everything. And that's kind of the fear of that first 2 years. It's like, you need to pick something, otherwise something's going to be given to you and it's not going to be something you want.
What was it that you picked?
So I didn't. I did what we call playing the game. And so straight out of training, we did one training exercise. And then the first big one I remember was we went to Norway, kind of pretty sure it's within that first few months. And then we got back from that and it was straight into Afghan buildup. So that kind of wasn't really looking into SQs at that time. No one really was. It was, we joined knowing we were going to Afghan kind of later that year. So I kind of just hadn't thought through any of that yet. Just wanted the experiences. Then I'd kind of see where I wanted to go.
How did you cope with knowing that you would be going to combat at some point?
I think at that point, kind of that immaturity again helped me. Of kind of a little, obviously you've got your fears and you'd be seeing it on the news. Like, I remember seeing 9/11, and I think that was something that kind of added to me wanting to join. I kind of then saw in the news our guys going over, and had about 5 years of seeing that initial part of Afghan going on. And then once you finished all that training, you just kind of want to go do your job. And I think that's what they're very good at, kind of brainwashing you into, almost like, you've just completed all of this, you want to go do it now.
So going over to Afghanistan, you would be doing a pre-deployment build-up. How long is that for the Marines for a PDT?
I have absolutely no idea, to be honest. I cannot remember. I can only remember one of the exercises. I think it was like the one just before we finished, kind of that last tick in the box. And that's kind of the one where you have your actors come in and you have amputees kind of with makeup kind of playing that role, and they really kind of thrust some of the things you're going to see on you. And they have foreign people kind of playing Afghans and like that speak a different language. So you have to kind of deal with that. And I think it's quite a good level for that kind of initial, as close as you're going to get anyway, doing it in the UK.
Do you think, you know, being at such a young age, you know, and describing yourself as a little bit immature at that point, do you think that you took all that part seriously, or in hindsight, do you think you could have taken that with a little bit more, you know, open eyes?
I definitely took it seriously. I think the immaturity side, like, I certainly wasn't stupid immature. I just wasn't really deep thinking about, we're going to Afghan and, you know, I could die, my friends could die. I just wasn't really thinking about that aspect. I knew it could happen, but it hadn't really clicked that that was reality yet.
When you knew that you were flying out there, what was going through your mind?
Yeah, you start super early, and again, it's, I kind of remember a bit of a buzz around the lads, like, you know, you've got your kit ready and you're setting off, and there's that kind of nerves, but no one talks about that because you're all trying to act hard and like that's not bothering you. So that's kind of just in the back of your head. But there's definitely that little buzz around everyone that you're about to go and actually start doing what you got trained to do.
Being in that sort of, you know, very alpha male environment, do you think the lads that probably would have had, you know, genuine concerns, genuine worries that they were going to go out there and, you know, A, have to take a life, or B, see a life be taken, do you think because it was so alpha male that they perhaps wouldn't have opened up and talked to perhaps a padre or their NCOs about what they were thinking at that point?
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. Like, I can't remember anyone ever saying a single kind of worry, or not negative, that's the wrong word, but, you know, not enjoying going or not looking forward to what we're about to do. That just, it wasn't spoke about. And even between kind of friends, like, I had some close friends at that point, it certainly wasn't something any of us kind of spoke to each other about.
Do you think not speaking about it was unhealthy?
It's kind of hard. So I think part of me kind of looking back and trying to understand things is, there's a part of me that feels the UK military could do a lot more. But then at the same time, there's a reason it's that way. Like, you're about to go to Afghan and you're about to go do these things. You can't be having those doubts and nerves already. So whilst, yes, it would have been more healthy to kind of openly talk about it, because there's nothing wrong, like, we were all guaranteed feeling that way. But you are that kind of brainwashed new Marine ready to go do it. And I think there's a reason they do that. But it is hard to find that balance of, I definitely, by the time I got to my second tour, I looked a little different.
Let's stay with your first tour initially. So landing in country, which airbase did you land at? How did you feel when you first get into, you know, your digs, your quarters, up base, and getting your first orders to perhaps move out?
Yeah, so we flew straight into Bastion, if that's correct. I don't think we had that long. I'd say, I think you get 2 weeks. It was definitely a week, maybe 2 weeks of kind of that initial, you're getting acclimatized to the heat, and you're going through that final checks and kind of learning a little more about kind of what's going on in the area you're actually going to deploy to. And we'd be having those through the build up, kind of that in coming in, and we'd have weekly or kind of every 2 weeks kind of have an int meeting and kind of hear what's going on. A lot of that initial start is just kind of a blur. Like, you're just going through your routine, getting your final kit and just getting ready to go. And then I just kind of remember that initial getting on the helos and heading off.
Going to your first FOB. How long was it before you got into contact?
So we arrived and we were taking over from, I believe it was two para, it was one of the para units. And they had, I think up until that point, the worst tour of anyone. They'd had extreme high casualty rates. And by the time we got there, I don't want to speak badly on anyone, because you kind of see the other side by the time you finish your tour.
Yeah.
But they were ready to go. Like, they wanted to get the hell out of there. And that handoff was probably speedier than we did at the end of our tour. Not that we wanted to do a good handover. We were the same situation. We wanted to get the hell out. But we did some patrols with them. But by the time we got there, their kind of I can't remember the words we used for it, but they could basically go about 200 meters without getting in a contact from the FOB. So it had really just closed in and there was no freedom of movement.
Wow.
So I remember doing the first kind of handover patrol with them, and can't remember at that point whether they were suspected Taliban that we kind of had captured and we brought back. And I can remember now looking back, just seeing that hatred in their eyes, like, because you're new at this point, you've not seen nothing.
Yeah.
And you're seeing these people that have just been there for this 7 months, and you can just see a difference in the way they look and the way they are looking at, like, the locals that we'd got that they suspected were Taliban. And I remember that sticking in my mind, kind of seeing that. And then, yeah, once that handover was done, it was within the first couple of days, I think, that we got a Chinese rocket into one of our Sanghas. Luckily, it kind of hit just below, like, the opening that the lads were in. But I remember that being that first initial, like, oh, fuck, that was actually a rocket fired at us. And it was like, yeah, we are actually here now, and this is real.
Did a switch get flipped in your mind at that point? The excitement of going in country, you know, with the lads that you trained with, getting to do what you've been trained to do. Did that excitement suddenly, you know, perhaps waver a little bit? You've got this initial contact, you've had a rocket, you know, indirect effective fire on you.
Yep.
Did the thought process start changing?
It didn't for me at that point. Like, I remember us all kind of, you know, rushing out to your positions and getting the rounds down. And at that point, it still hadn't, even though that switch had kind of gone like, this is real.
Yeah.
That real switch of like, fuck, didn't kind of come till later. But I think for the start of our tour, because we knew how bad the paras had it and kind of how heavily they'd been hit, I wouldn't say cocky, but we definitely felt like not untouchable, a little cocky. I can't think of a better word. Yeah. Like, we'd got through the first kind of, I'd say 2 months, and we'd had a lot of contacts. Like, it was every day, like a lot of times, multiple times a day. And we hadn't really had that big hit. So we definitely not switching off. That never happened. But definitely internally, probably thinking a bit like, we're pretty good. Like, we're doing good out here. And then that quickly changes.
Would it, you know, having all these contacts, were you fairly lucky in the fact that you weren't getting casualties, that you weren't getting, you know, KIAs? Is that why you're getting this sort of cockiness that, you know, nothing can touch us?
I mean, I'd definitely pull it down a bit to the commanders we had. Like, not that the paras were doing it wrong, but we learned from their mistakes, as everyone did. Like, every tour, you're learning new SOPs of what to do and what works, what doesn't. And they started their tour and they weren't bombering. So the vellum, the metal detector. So they'd go out and kind of just have that in a backpack and went on their patrols, and they were just getting hit all the time and explosions. And we kind of adapted when we started, and we were like, the point man will bomber every step. So that point man has that metal detector out and is sweeping the ground with his left arm and rifling his right arm. And that's what I started my kind of tour doing. I was doing that. And that definitely, that helped us for that initial, that initial part. I think they had to then kind of change their tactics a little bit. They weren't getting us as easy because we were doing that.
Yeah. So obviously, you know, going through this first deployment, did it get easier as you were going through it, or were there certain points on this first deployment that really turned quite dark?
No, it, definitely went darker. And I remember the first kind of initial kind of switch was so we had a Afghan National Army base. They were like, I'd say about 100 meters away from us. And it's funny, those distances out here don't seem like much, but out there, they were a lot bigger. And kind of between us and them, it was like this tiny little village, but it was just deserted. And you had to kind of walk through it to get to the Afghan army. So that was always shitty. But we actually went on an ambush. So we set off at like, I can't remember, like 2 a.m., 3 a.m. And it was our first kind of night patrol, like really going out at night. And we kind of passed the Afghan National Army base and we were coming up on a compound. And then it was the first time we just got that bang. And yeah, you definitely, that moment kind of hits you. And it was one of our lads, I think he was about three people behind me. And you just start hearing noise then, and the Afghan army started firing at us, kind of just opening up as they do, because they don't have a clue and they also don't really care. Like, they just pull the trigger and they don't really think about where it's going. So we had that coming in. So that kind of, we didn't know where that was coming from and who it was. So we were thinking we were getting contacted. Luckily that kind of stopped. And I think maybe they'd realized, or maybe a commander had managed to kind of get them to stop firing at us. And then I remember just seeing one of our lads on the ground and he'd lost his leg and the medics were treating him. And then we got him onto the stretcher and me and three of the lads kind of got around it and started carrying it back. And I remember just kind of looking at one of your friends kind of lying there. And I think it was one of the medics kept saying, just keep him awake, keep him awake. So I was just talking to him, kind of holding the stretcher with one hand and kind of gripping his hand with the other and just speaking to him about crap, about football and just anything. And then you get back from that. And that's definitely that was that first kind of like, fuck, we got hit. Yeah. And yeah, that started changing it and kind of making it more real from that point.
So as you mentioned earlier, was that situation, then that was the moment when the big switch flipped and you realized that, you know, we could get injured, we could die out here?
That was definitely a switch. Like, it became real. Still, it wasn't till when I actually lost to my commander, and that's when I really got the big switch. And that was on New Year's Eve. So we would we'd swap over and a section would go stop with the Afghan army. So we were trying to train them as all the British troops were doing at that time. Mm. So we'd go stop with them and kind of do, I think it was like a week on, and then we'd like rotate. And I remember that morning, and actually it was the night before, and we were sitting down and having our meal, and Amzi, our corporal, was kind of just discussing the patrol the next day. And you'd always leave someone, like two people behind, to protect like the Afghan base. So he picked me and a female medic we had with us. And then they headed off in the morning. And that's definitely where the big switch kind of hit. And I remember just sitting around and just checking in with the Afghan army that they're actually awake and doing some resemblance of a job. And then just heard a huge explosion, and just, you'd kind of heard them at that point, but this was a big one, and kind of just knew straight away, like, fuck, something just went wrong. And I think for me, this has probably been the hardest thing for me to deal with, kind of definitely looking back, is because I'll go into it more, but yeah, kind of now I struggle I did struggle a long time after kind of being okay, not being okay, yeah. because I wasn't on that patrol. So I just had that guilt of not going and not being there. But I remember the explosion going and then just hearing fire and rounds going down and then kind of just sitting around and getting up on the, I think we had a sniper rifle and a 0.5 up on the roof and kind of looking out. And then I got a call from, I believe it was the 2IC. And he kind of told me at that point that Alms, the air corporal, was dead. And then my best friend as well had been hit, and they didn't know how bad it was at this point, but his arm was pretty bad. And I remember just kind of, yeah, just going dark. And I remember having to go down and then tell that female medic that kind of news. And she just broke down crying. And I remember just kind of sitting there like, fuck. And then the 2IC told me they were getting ICOM chatter and they were talking about hitting the Afghan base. So it was only me and her there and the Afghans. So at that point, I just kind of had to make that switch again and went up on the 0.5 and very dark at that point and was almost kind of hoping we got hit because just wanted to explode and let that anger out. But we had to sit there for quite a few hours as those lads went through the CASIVAC and getting back. And I can just remember the section coming back, but not the full section. And that was just a moment that has always been ingrained and very weird, and just no one speaking and just the emotions of that kind of that moment. Like, we'd gone from pretty much planning a New Year's Eve little barbecue as much as you can out there to then everything just changing. And I think that was the moment for everyone that it kind of really hit. That it's different now.
Just taking it from your perspective there, you got several things there that I can pick up on. One, you almost feel guilty that you weren't on that patrol with them. Mm-hmm. What was it like emotionally for you? You know, you're saying there that you wanted the contact, you wanted to get into action, but you were lying there on the 0.5, just looking out there for motion for all that time, while you know that the rest of the patrol is dealing with those lads, dealing with those casualties. How did that feel emotionally for you?
I think at the time I wasn't feeling much, like very numb. Like, I remember being on the roof. It wasn't a big compound that the Afghan army was in. And I can remember just hearing a medic kind of sobbing down below me. But I had to kind of stay switched on of, if we do get hit, it's kind of, there's only two of us British troops here and the rest of the Afghans, and you can't rely too heavily on that for defense. Yeah, just very numb at that point. I think I was so focused on my job and kind of being on that 0.5 and looking for any movement and getting ready to get hit that I wasn't really processing it fully. And then I remember it was dark. Like, they set off in the morning and they didn't get back till it was dark. So it was kind of a full day of just being there. And then they got back in. And I definitely, looking back now, like, that changed my life and kind of changed who I was at that point, in not being equipped to process it or really understand that. And then I remember that was kind of our last day of patrols. So we went back to FOB Gibraltar, where we were with kind of the rest of the sections. And we were meant to be done at that point. Like, we were switching now to FOB defense for four, I think it was about 4-day rotations or something. And I remember our sergeant major saying that we were going to do another 2 days of patrols. And I can just remember, like, we were furious and just, we were broken. And like to be told we're going back out straight away was definitely a hard thing to understand. But it's definitely a moment I can look back at now and be like, that was the right call for the sergeant major of someone in his position to make, because we couldn't just sit in that fob for 4 days now, dwelling, like we had to get back out there and be put back in that situation and realize it, you can't stop. And it's kind of that hard balance I think the military has of how do you deal with the extreme things the guys are going through, but at the same time we have to do a job, and there isn't time to sit around and cry and dwell. Like, you have to go back and you have to perform at that top level again, otherwise more bad things are going to happen. So you can't have that kind of off switch. So that's definitely something I think affects you more later, but at the time I can't see another way of how it should be or how you could do it.
So, you know, obviously going through these things, you haven't got, you know, the time to compartmentalize, you know, deal with everything that you're going through. At this point, were they doing decompression in Germany on the way back from Afghanistan, or is this something that was coming later?
So we got what was it called? Something like trims, or I can't remember the exact name for it, but you have like a 5 minute sit down. And it's like, you doing okay? And it's like, yeah. And then that's kind of all you have at that point.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the tour, we did 2 weeks in, I believe it was Cyprus. You have a few beers and that's kind of it as far as getting ready to go back.
Do you think that's enough to prepare you for being taken away from, you know, your brothers and sisters that you've served with, that you've had these, you know, shared experiences with, you've lived through these moments with, you've just had these, you know, this little bit of time in Cyprus before you're coming back to a first world country, to people that are not going to understand or comprehend the things that you've seen and lived through?
I'd say no. But again, it's what can you do better? It's kind of hard because I try and be open-minded to think of what the military is and the job we do. As a business sounds harsh, but it is a business in a way. It's a company, it's a machine. And like, if I look back now, every member of that troop has had issues. Like, you lose count of friends you've lost through suicide, to friends now starting to speak about kind of they're not doing okay. But when you look at that kind of ratio of amount of people, how does the military function and deal with that? Because I know only for my personal self, like now looking back, I can see changes in myself through my career as it carried on. But I think that we have to focus on what happens to people. But for me, it was definitely as I left, I think those things started coming up more.
Obviously, you know, like you say, being in the military, you're expected to, you know, perform at a high level. You're expected to perhaps take a life to defend a life. You're right in what you're saying. At a certain point, it isn't right for you to sit down and talk about things, but it is very much something that the aftercare that you have to talk about. And I think that's what you're alluding to there, that when you leave the military, perhaps it almost feels like the door is shut and there isn't that support, or, you know, the availability to talk to a professional who would understand of everything that you've been through your military career, from being, you know, broken down on your basic training and built back up as a serviceable soldier, and then going through, you know, everything that you went through in Afghanistan in combat, to then just going, right, it's time for you to find a civilian job. And I think that is where, you know, the suicides really happen, you know, when people start having, you know, hypervigilance and turn into self-medication to get through the day. So if you could just talk us through it, what was it like for you leaving the military? Was it your choice? Was it the military's choice that you were leaving at that time?
Yeah, so after that first tour, I got back, and then I straight away tried to go and join SBS, and I got declined for medical for hearing.
Right.
And I kind of had to go through that process of, basically, are they going to kick me out? And thankfully, I kind of got towards the later stages of that, and they said I could stay in, but they told me I couldn't take that next step up, which, looking back now, is stupid. Like, I can be a commando, but I can't go and do this next step.
Yeah.
But at that point, I wasn't going to question anything. Like, I did not want to leave. I had no intention of leaving. So I carried on. And then definitely as I went on, like, I changed. And I remember getting to that kind of second tour and just not having the same bond with everyone, because I wasn't the same anymore. I didn't want that closeness, because I'd experienced what that brings. And then, so I did 10 years in total, and then my hearing caught up with me again. And this time I did get medically discharged for it. And that was kind of definitely a really hard moment of, I think I was definitely ready to leave, as in I wanted to kind of leave. Like, I didn't see a path that was there before of kind of doing that tier one special forces or even mountain leader. And I got another injury in that second tour, which kind of damaged my shoulder, so that I didn't see a path where I was going to develop to what I thought I had in my head when I kind of joined. So I remember doing my medical discharge, and I remember you sit down at this big table, and it's all these Navy medical high up officers, and I remember almost being interrogated and just kind of looking at them. It's like, they, because it's your hearing, it's like, it's not like you lost a leg.
Yeah.
So it's, they're looking at what doctors have said and what you're saying, and they're basically trying to see if you're just trying to get out.
Yeah.
And I remember just kind of losing my temper, and just, there was this particular one doctor on the board that was just an ass. And this is a hard time anyway. Like, I'm realizing 10 years of my career is now coming to an end, and he was kind of questioning me on it. And I just turned and looked at him and said, if you will upgrade me and tell me I won't be downgraded again, great, let's end this and I'll crack on. And they wouldn't. So I was like, that's why, because you get to say before you go on that board if you want to stay in or if you want to leave. And I'd say I wanted to leave. So I just said, if you can guarantee I can just be normal now and stay in and not going to go through this again, then great. But if you can't, then I want to leave. And I remember leaving that room and getting the medical discharge and just sitting in like the waiting room and not breaking down, but mentally just being like, fuck, it's actually over. Like, what am I going to do now? And just, it's just weird. Like, that becomes your whole identity. That's who you are. That's all I knew. Like, from, you know, before I joined, from basically being a kid to who you are now, 10 years later, like, that was my whole adult life. And that's definitely, like, I remember just leaving there and getting in my car and just being like, wow, it's actually, it's over.
Wow. So it almost, you know, being medically discharged, I would say that's almost, you know, a decision taken away from you.
Mm-hmm.
I believe, you know, those decisions where it's taken away from you, A, can be helpful because you're not umming and ahhing over a 50-50 decision, but also mm-hmm. it can be a little bit devastating because you haven't got the power to make that decision, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Did that affect you over the coming weeks after you started, you know, going through the paperwork and actually leaving and thinking about, oh, I need a civilian job? Did that start affecting you then, that, you know, the power of that decision was taken away from mm-hmm. you?
I think at that point, like, I'd met my now wife, and she lives in, well, we live in America now, as you said earlier. So we were kind of deciding, was she going to move to the UK or was I going to move there? So that kind of helped in that aspect of, well, that choice is made now. Mm. It's kind of, if I stay in, that's the way we're going to have to go. If they kick me out, then we're going to go that way. But looking back now, that definitely kind of, it gave me that new focus of like, this is what I'm doing now. But it also meant I didn't really fully deal with ending that chapter and kind of leaving, because I kind of just jumped straight into that new life.
At what point did, you know, your old life, so to speak, start catching up with you, when perhaps traits and characteristics of a darker side was coming out?
I think I definitely realized, I mean, my wife will probably talk better to it, but definitely that first year was difficult. Kind of, you know how it is being in the military, that the drinking culture, and you work hard, you play hard, and definitely moving to a new country and a different culture. And I hadn't made that adjustment yet. I was still, you know, if I went out drinking, it was 100%. And I'm trying to get in fights, or I was having breakdowns and kind of not remembering anything. And she'd kind of tell me the things, and, you know, from breakdowns over Afghan to other kind of things. So I kind of realized, like, there's something in there that I don't know how to deal with yet. And I think I just kind of tried to shut that door, tried not to drink as much, stop going out. Because even now, like, there's certain times, like for Amzi's memorial every year, like, it's New Year's Eve, everyone goes out and gets pissed. And that's what I used to do. And that night would always end extremely bad, either in a police vehicle, in a fight, broken down. Like, it never went well. So I've kind of had to learn what my triggers are and how to change things for myself. And I'm very conscious now of when I drink, who I'm around, and what state I'm in before I start. Like, I can still drink and I still have fun, but I know now, like, the second I start feeling something, or if a negative thought comes in my head, I have to stop. Otherwise, it's going to go down that dark path again.
Hmm. Obviously, being in America, you know, the drinking culture is different to what it'd be mm-hmm. here in some of the British cities. So mm-hmm. perhaps you're quite fortunate in that respect, that uh-huh. your drinking is almost a pastime relaxation than it is over mm-hmm. here, where it's an all-night session.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that's definitely difficult to get used to at first, but it definitely helped.
Yeah,
as I progressed.
At those early days, were you able to see these destructive behaviors in yourself, or, you know, is it that, you know, you've got that angel on shoulder, you've got your wife there who's mm-hmm. you know, guiding you through these early days?
Yeah, I think that's the side where the military can do better, because these behaviors are there, like, at that time, but it just gets covered up. I'm sure every unit's got their own saying, but for us, it's like, royally, royally, you just, that's what you are. You go a little crazy and it's fine. And then when you get out, especially being in this country that does have that different drinking culture, I very quickly saw the things that were accepted before were not the norm for people here. And she was definitely a huge, huge help. Like, if I hadn't had that, I don't know where it would have ended. Kind of just having someone to kind of talk to you and support you, even though they probably shouldn't. Like, if you look back at how bad sometimes you can be and kind of the breakdowns I'd have to like smashing things and just losing it, and having someone that sticks with you through that definitely helps massively to kind of come through and kind of learn for yourself, how do I stop this, and what are those, like I said before, those triggers that are causing it, and how do I eliminate them from my life?
And another good thing about being in America is the veteran community and the veteran culture differs a lot from here in the UK. Mm-hmm. They tend to talk about more mental health issues, TBIs, depression, PTS, mm-hmm. In their veterans. Is that something that you've looked at professionally? Have you sought advice of going down a medical route or a foundation route while you've been over there in the US?
Yeah, so they're so much better. And I haven't been home in 5 years, but from what I know of when I was there, it's so different. That was kind of a struggle for me at first, because their culture is so different here, and kind of being a veteran, but I didn't feel like I could call myself a veteran because I'm not an American veteran. So when you look at all the things they get, and from stupid things to discounts to medical help to buying a mortgage, like, they get so much, but none of that applies to me. So I think at first I really struggled to fit in. They have a very different culture and I didn't feel a part of it. Like, I felt very isolated. I had no kind of British, I didn't have that group around me anymore that kind of had been through what we'd been through, in my mind anyway, like my core group of friends that I had. So I did feel very on the outside, and I struggled with that for a while. And then I think I've started to look a little more now, and I've started meeting some great veterans. I think the hardest thing for me and other Brits that are probably out here is seeing all the help the Americans get and the lack of anything we get. And especially me being living in this country, like, I don't even have any of the resources of being in the UK and those kind of groups. So it still feels very isolated.
Yeah.
But it's definitely cool to see some of the things that are getting done now. And I know you've had Mike on your podcast and Cody, and I met those a couple of weeks ago, and we were speaking about the I think it's called the brain resilience or something.
Yeah.
And just hearing what they went through, and also sitting down to lunch, and kind of we were talking about what were the issues they were having, and my wife just kind of turned around and looked at me and was just like, that's everything you have. And yeah, but at the same time, it's hard then, because you look at it and it's like, I think that course is like $12,000 or something. And it's like, well, I can't just go do it. So it's kind of hard seeing some of the things they get to go do and the help and support they get compared to what we get and the developments they're making in the drug market, to kind of psychedelics, to the brain scanning and kind of redeveloping how those pathways work in your brain. It's so, at least from my time of what I know, what's going on kind of for veterans in the UK, we're not even close.
That's one of the main reasons I've started this podcast, is to try and raise awareness for British veterans and also highlight how well the US veterans are doing it. I mean, how do you feel? Obviously, you know, you mentioned that you met Cody and Michael. Cody is almost got a Hollywood celebrity status about him. He's so empowering. He's so positive.
He's a character.
He is a character, and he's got this monumental social following. And you can say the same about, you know, Eddie Penny. You know, they've got this celebrity status. And how does that make you feel, knowing that American veterans can gain this notoriety?
Yeah. I think I've gone through different paths. So the reason they get that, it all comes down to the culture of the country. Yeah. Like, being a veteran in this country is so much different than the UK. Like, from everyone saying thank you for your service, something as simple as that. Like, that's not something I've ever heard in the UK, from like civilian to veteran, to the help they get after. And what's funny is their complaint about the help they get still, because they want more, and rightly so. But I look at it and I'm like, damn, you guys get really looked after. Like, even from, I mean, take myself, like, from my hearing to my shoulder injury, if that was an American, they would be getting paid money to help with that recovery to their afterlife as a civilian. Like, nearly every veteran I've met that I'm friends with in this country still gets something to kind of help with their life now. Whereas for us, it's like, bye, you're done.
Yeah.
And to get that help, the only ones I've seen that are really helping is the other vets, like people like yourself doing this podcast from Reorg, which is a Royal Marine charity that got set up from he was serving, I think he's out now, but all those other groups. And it's like, good that we're pushing to help ourselves, but at the same time, where's that support from the government to really help that? Like, for me, it was only a couple of weeks ago, I have bad hearing and I struggle sometimes, and people think I'm rude because I'm ignoring them and I just don't hear them. So I was looking at hearing aids and seeing what help I could get in the UK, and I found a scheme that the UK was doing, and literally the page said their applications are full. Like, they helped their couple of thousand people, they met their quota, they're done. It's like, well, what about everyone else? Like, you just don't get help now. And you just wouldn't see that here. So it's just, it's very different.
Do you think over time, you know, the British culture will catch up with the Americans? And if so, it seems to be at a very slow pace at the minute. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, we're still seeing the repercussions of this 20-odd war in the Middle East, with suicide rates with veterans here in the UK. Do you think we're ever going to catch up with the Americans on how we look after the veterans?
To the same level, I'd have to be honest and say no, because the right culture of our country is different. And I don't see how that changes. And maybe it will, I hope it does. But that's such an embedded thing in Americans, of like being proud of their country, being proud of the people that represent their country. Whereas I don't know how it was for yourself, but I know for lots of people I know, for us, like, we go out and it's more someone's getting a fight with you, or like, I remember getting called baby killer and all kinds of things. There's just not that same culture for that respect. I do think we can catch up on the science and the actual help side of actually looking at these things, and all of us talking about it. And actually, it's something that I'm trying to think more of what I can do now with kind of being here and being able to show. Because if we can let everyone see, we'll do it for ourselves. We'll build that up and we'll demand that kind of that help. But it's just how we do that, and it will definitely take longer than it would in this country. But hopefully we can keep pushing and get there.
Do you, you know, reach out and get in contact with other British veterans that are living in the US?
So my best friend, so the one that got hit with Almsy, he's actually the reason I met my wife out here. So he lives out here. So we talk. As far as that, don't really have any other British veterans. Like, I've tried groups before, but it's not the same as actually having people. Like, this country is so big. Like, it's not like the UK where I could literally get to anywhere that day and go see anyone. Whereas here, you're looking at a week-long drive, or you have to pay for a plane ticket, so it's not quite as easy. I forgot where I was going. What were we saying again?
Well, what I was sort of alluding to is, you know, if you were talking to British veterans that were living out in the US, is there a proportion of them that perhaps went to the US for, you know, extra care, for perhaps trying ayahuasca for, you know, mental reasons, or you know, just trying these veteran foundations to try and help with ease the suffering that they're going through?
So I definitely haven't met or know of anyone yet that has kind of moved here to get that help. Because as I said, the hard thing with being here is everything's for American veterans. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's just hard when you see that kind of help there, but it's like US veteran apply and we don't really fit in that. But I actually, weirdly enough, got in touch with one of the lads I did that first tour with, and I'm speaking to him tomorrow, and we've probably not spoken 14 years now. And it's kind of just that bond of, you just kind of, you drift apart, but then you see each other and it's like, well, let's catch up. And he's doing some cool things now. So he got a medal from that tour. I can't remember which one, the Military Cross, I believe.
Wow.
And he's actually selling that now to start up a little organization to help veterans. But in speaking with him, he's actually looking at coming over here. And he has, I believe it's a science university or something that's looking into the mushroom side of things.
Yeah.
And that kind of help. And they're looking at actually sending him over here to one of the places that does that. So that's something I'm going to connect with him about and hopefully be able to show that. But even that shows where we are, that we're having to send people to this country to get that help. Like, why can't we do that? Like, it's literally a mushroom. Like, we do could you, do that in the UK.
Do you think it's perhaps to do with the medical care system in the United States, where it's insurance-based? It's very much corporate America, so to speak, whereas UK, it's the National Health Service. It's run by the government. Do you think, you know, hard to say it, but privatising the NHS would open up corporate doors to help UK veterans in the way that the American medical system does?
That's a hard one. So for me, like, living here, gonna get hate now, but their medical system was one of the worst I've seen. From it's kind of weird. It's like, you could say the system here is the best in the world, but also the worst for kind of first world country. So, I mean, take, for example, our daughter. Like, we paid $4,000 for her birth. The UK, you don't have to pay to have a kid. If you get cancer here, like, you're bankrupt. Your whole family's going bankrupt. So it's got its terrible sides. But then at the same time, you look at the UK and you can have something wrong with you and get told, well, you can get an appointment in a year. So I think there's a in-between that would be perfect. I think kind of if we switched kind of the lower care to the American system, because I think the struggle that I see in the UK is kind of the hospital beds getting taken up with with things that shouldn't really be there. Mm. And kind of those people that, you know, cut their finger are going to go to A&E to be like, I need stitches. Whereas maybe if you had to pay for that yourself, those people might not be as quick to just go down.
Yeah.
But I definitely think on that other end of, if you get that life-changing disease, illness or something, that shouldn't, you're already dealing with that. Imagine then dealing with knowing you can't afford the treatment, or if you try to, you're going to bankrupt your partner and probably destroy your child's life at the same time, because you're going to lose your house and everything. So I definitely think there's an in-between there to be found. I definitely think we need to look at how things are done here, because like things that we're talking about, yeah, I'm sure they are paid with that money. That is, yeah, that biz, everything's a business, and yeah, they produce a lot of money, but they are putting that money into those areas to look at that help. Whereas we are not, and we aren't producing that income to push that way. So I definitely think there's an in-between there that could be found.
Do you think it's, you know, the veteran foundations in America, you know, there's quite a few that's set up specifically for that reason. If you look at the charities in the UK, yes, you've got the Royal British Legion that, you know, does things for, you know, perhaps homeless veterans, getting them on their feet to start off with, Help for Heroes. You know, there are known charities here in the UK. And, you know, when I spoke to Craig Harrison, he, you know, did say a lot of them were just shit.
Mm.
And they didn't really do a lot for, you know, veterans' health. They're, you know, there's the odd occasional good charity out there, but it just seems that he was almost stating that a few of them were quite corrupt. Do you think that's another big difference, the way that these charities and foundations are run?
I think, so one of the plus sides of how much Americans are patriotic, and if that happened here, people would burn that place down. Like if they found corruption in something that was set up to help their veterans like that, they'd be pretty pissed. Whereas the hard thing I think our charities have is getting that money. Like it's not cheap to help us. Like if you think you get that kid, and I don't know how much it takes to take someone through training, but I think I read it's a lot of money. And then they get injured on that first tour at 19 years old. You've now got to pay for them their whole life. Like if you look at it in America or something, like you could be helping that person, and where does that money come from? So it's definitely a complicated matter. I was just looking into Canada, and I'm sure you put a link, but I think Cody posted about her, but she's shining the light on that. And they kind of went down the route of actually ending people's life that wanted to end it, and how, yeah, that's getting mistreated.
Euthanasia, yeah.
Yeah. And that's certainly not the way to go.
No.
And it's definitely worrying to see how that's used. And yeah, if you put it in that numbers term, as I just said, of, and the way she said it as well, you take that young man, young woman, and they get injured, and you've got the government now has to look after them. You can guarantee there's some shady stuff that's going to go on, because they don't want to, and no one wants to deal with the broken. You want to use them for the plus, and then it's move them along. So there's definitely a balance we need to find of how in the UK do we build that up, because from the money we get, but again that comes from the culture, whereas if you get people like Cody, like if I talk to civilians here, they know those people, like, yeah, Eddie Gallagher, like I did some pictures for him, he's a great guy, people know who he is here. If that was in the UK, like you look at our Royal Marine that pretty much went through a very, not the same, but similar experience as Eddie. You go through the street and ask who he is, no one's going to know. No one will have a clue. And it's that culture here that just changes that from, like, you look at the president of the country spoke about Eddie and what he was going through, no one really spoke about that, and it very quickly went away. So it's hard because that culture needs to change. And I think that's the hard thing of how do we change that in the UK? And culture, I think there's people that are leading that.
Yeah, I think culture change at the end of the day has to be driven from the top. So when I say driven from the top, it has to be driven from the UK government. Mm-hmm. Are we going to see this at the moment in, you know, the financial climate with everything else that's going on, the war in Ukraine? I think you know, they're going to be front side focused elsewhere. Just talking about yourself again then. So obviously, you know, you are still very much on a healing journey. You know, you alluded to me that, you know, you were quite apprehensive about doing this podcast. Uh-huh. So what does the future look like for yourself? And, you know, where do you see yourself moving forward for, you know, treatment and helping yourself?
I think the big thing for me and for all of us was to really start talking to each other. Like, especially for that, I've been here about 7 years now, and I'd never bring up I'm a veteran ever. When we meet people, me and my wife, she'd always be the one that said, he used to be this. I hate bringing it up, and I never say it, but I'm trying to adjust that to actually talk more and actually embrace other veterans, even though they are from a different country, and being more open to that. Whereas, like, I've had friends, like, lived in Alaska, and Jeff Reed, Navy SEAL, lives out there. He was a great friend, and we had exactly the same tours. So it was good to kind of meet him. That was definitely a pivotal moment to me being out here. That was, I think my wife could see I wasn't doing very well, and I was kind of struggling of, what am I going to do? Where do I go? And she'd just done something through her work where she met him, and she came back and was like, you have to meet this dude. And we just kind of decided, like, you know what? I do need to get away. So I booked a flight and went out to Alaska and did some photography for him and got to meet him. And that was an awesome start to kind of getting to know the veterans here and kind of feeling more part of that world. And I've tried to, it's definitely taken time, but I've tried to open up more and meet different veterans, from like meeting Cody and Mike and hearing their story and kind of embracing that it's okay to talk about that now. Whereas definitely back when I left PTSD and didn't really know what that was, wasn't spoke about, no one I knew was really speaking about it. And it's definitely getting out there now. So I think it's just for all of us as veterans to keep pushing that and keep highlighting that. And it's good for the kind of few people in the UK and that veteran end that are kind of reaching into that more celebrity role to use their voice and definitely speak and use their platform to get the actual civilian people looking more into our world and what help we need, because that's what they have so big here. Like, you have someone like Cody, like, it's not just veterans, it's civilians and everyone that's following him and other people like him that have huge followings. They're civilian people here, look into that and they enjoy that and they want to help with that, from raising money to supporting the companies that veterans start up. Whereas we definitely need to make that switch and help that develop more, and those people that are there to use their platforms to push that and help that market grow for us.
Try and give it that American spin almost.
And I think that's one of the hard things. It's one of the hard things I found is we're definitely not as loud as Americans and outspoken. And that's kind of the hard thing of, well, you have to be a bit. If you want to get somewhere and you want people to listen, you do. You have to speak up and say, like, hey, our country needs to do better. Our community needs to do better. Like, I go here and they actually have, like, their veteran communities that, like, all kind of live together and all serve together, and they've grown up there most of their lives. And we just don't have that same community, and we definitely need to keep growing it. And I think it is growing. but it's definitely gotta, we gotta keep pushing it.
So looking back on your, you know, your 10-year military career, looking back at everything you've experienced and this point you are now in your life, what advice would you take from this point now and give to that, you know, 18-year-old lad that was joining the military?
It's definitely a hard question. It's hard because I don't regret anything. I regret the bad things happened.
Yeah.
I wish I could change them, but I have accepted that I can't. And those experiences have led me to who I am now. And I'm definitely more happy with who I am now than I was. So it's that journey. I wouldn't change much or tell myself much. I definitely think that self-awareness, which doesn't come from being that 18-year-old lad, it comes from the corporals and the sergeants and sergeant majors, that we do start talking about this. And I do think towards the end of my career, it was starting a bit. And I think maybe it has hopefully developed more, that people talk about that. And there's so many veterans now from Afghan that are kind of showing the light of what we went through. And I think the recruits going through training now are kind of get to see that a little more. But that's what I'd say is those people in those positions above need to speak and make sure people developing from that young age know that this is an issue and it will affect a lot of people, and that's okay. And that they can talk to their oppos next to them, they can talk above, and they're not just going to be slapped back down. So I think that's where we need to kind of grow.
Yeah, that's some good advice. Now looking at it from, you know, a person that could be, you know, leaving the military through their own choice or through the choice of the military, what advice would you give to them for their transition period from military life to civilian life?
Plan. Make a solid plan, and kind of like the military, know that plan's going to change. So I'd say the most important thing is to make sure you've got that community around you, from your friends to maybe other people that have left, like stay in touch with them, learn from what they've experienced. And I think the hard thing for all military people, and I know for myself, was when you join, you're very focused. Like, you have this aim of that Green Beret. It's that, that's what I want to get. And when you leave, it's, where does that focus go? So I think having something to put that in early on helps. I know for myself, I kind of left and I didn't really know where I was going. I didn't know what work I wanted to do. So that was definitely difficult, of kind of having those moments of, what do I do? And definitely being here, the big struggle was a lot of the things I thought of going to do, because I'm not an American citizen, I couldn't do those. So like police or fire, I couldn't go into those kind of areas. So definitely just planning more, kind of think what path you want, and make sure you've got some people around you that are going to stay with you and contact you. And I think that's something we're getting better with. I know for myself, I've started kind of just looking back at my career and being like, oh, how's that guy that I used to work with? And like giving a message and being like, hey, do you want to catch up? How's life going? And it's so surprising that you do that, and realizing how hard everyone's had it, and nearly everyone I've reached out to isn't okay, or at least at some point hasn't been okay.
Yeah.
And it makes you feel bad that you kind of sat in your own darkness by yourself, and you think it's just you and that no one else, like these feelings are just yours. And then you start reaching out and talking to people and you realize, oh, they went through it and they went through it. So it's just, let's just start talking more. so we don't have to keep going to funerals and getting messages from our friends saying, oh, did you hear about this person we used to know or this friend? So I think it's just that bond that we have so strong when we're in and serving, and we need to keep it when we get out.
Absolutely, 100% agree. You know, you could send them a message on, you know, their darkest day, and that one message could just bring them back to the light. It could be that one moment of picking their phone up and seeing that they've got a text message from you, and they're like, shit, that person cares. And that message alone could have pulled them from the brink. So I absolutely 100% agree with your message there. That's absolutely brilliant. It's been brilliant, you know, having this perspective of a UK veteran living in America, you know, doing your photography with the US vets as well. I think you've got this such a unique perspective. And then obviously with your own journey that you're going through, you've given us some, you know, some very good insights, and hopefully a lot of advice that, you know, UK veterans that are going to be watching or listening to this are going to take on board. And maybe some of the US veterans that subscribe to the channel are going to be looking at this and thinking, oh shit, the Brits do have it slightly tougher than what we do. So it's been an absolute pleasure having you on.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for, you know, sharing those very, you know, personal, meaningful stories, you know, for the first time on a podcast. That really means a lot to me. And, you know, sharing your advice on how we should help each other as a brotherhood. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. More of us need to do this, whether it's podcast or posting or just talking. Like, we've got to come together, and what our government isn't doing for us, we need to start pushing and demanding, and this is a start to that. So hopefully it can help someone. And I think even talking from my own personal view, it helps me. Like, it helps me getting these things out that I've never spoke about other than probably to my wife. So I think we need to start talking more, and hopefully we can help some more people. So thank you. Thank you for having me on.
It's my pleasure and honor. Thank you.